1850-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. I've a retired Garda on the line. Eddie McBride, 2 years left. I've Des, a retired Garda, and I've James Bunyan, a retired Cork clerk. James, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
You were listening to the 1 o'clock news and Paul Reynolds' revelations. A source close to the former Garda Commissioner Martin Callanan saying he delayed withdrawing the use of the word disgusting to describe the behaviour of the Garda whistleblowers following advice from the Department of Justice officials, that it was made clear to him when the Secretary General Brian Purcell of the Department of Justice called out to his house on Monday evening that there would be disquiet at the cabinet the following morning. It's quite clear that Martin Callanan was told to go, wasn't it? Wasn't he?
Ah, well, Joe, in the ways of the world and the way that the world works, messages are often transmitted in code, Joe.
And you would have been well used to that. You were district court clerk for 30 years. Well used to receiving those messages, surely.
Well, they were often indecipherable, Joe.
Do you think this message was indecipherable?
Well, Joe, I suppose in the Westerns and long ago, you and I would be familiar with the phrase, a man must do what a man must do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the debate has taken place as to whether or not what was disgusting referring to. And I saw Martin Callanan on television, and I would suspect that in the heat of the day after a long day of grilling, in a forum to which he mightn't have been accustomed, that it was probably an off-the-cuff comment that reflected what is now put forward as the printing and the dissemination of information that was in Pulse. But it does go to show, Joe, I think, that the kind of skill that a Garda commissioner needs. Garda Commissioner Callanan would have been used to heavy shelling in the witness box. He would have been in court many, many a time, and he would have been used to the forum. But I think the PAC is a new kind of forum where there's certainly people going in there will have to attend a FOS course.
You also say that in your experience, sending communication to the Department of Justice was like sending it to a shredder.
Well, Joe, I was involved in two disputes with the Department of Justice. I was a very young district court clerk in Waterford, and then I had the position of branch secretary in the court service, branch secretary of the court branch of the PSEU. And I am one of the individuals, very few people can say that they sat at the boardroom table in the Department of Justice and sat opposite officials who genuinely had no idea of the service that I delivered. And seasoned conservative colleagues embarked on a walk to rule to get a hearing in the Department of Justice. And there were many colourful comments used to describe them. But, Joe, I can tell you without fear of contradiction that they definitely had a shredder before shredders were invented in the Department of Justice. You never got a reply to correspondence sent there. There was a unique method of dealing with it. If you didn't read the letter, then you didn't have to deal with it. Or if you read it, you put it in a pile of documents from which it never emerged. And that is the kernel of the current problem with the Gardaí, Judge Joe, is that the investment has never, the Gardaí have never got the investment. I mean, when I came to Vermoy in 75.
Yeah, but in 2008, they got a lot of money to put in this new digitised for recording phone calls in 20 Garda stations digitally. So they did get money then. I don't think it's an issue of money. But the letter that Martin Callanan sent to the Department of Justice for the immediate attention of the minister on March the 11th didn't get to him until 12:40 on Tuesday of this week, 2 days ago. So before Patrick's Day, and he was in the country before Pat for 5 days before he left for Mexico. So what happened to the letter that he sent? Did that end up in a shredder from the Garda Commissioner?
Well, Joe, that letter
and then
would
someone
have to
be
parsed.
Put it back together again and gave it to the Taoiseach on Sunday.
It would have to be parsed, analysed and reanalysed, and it would have to do the rounds. Now, I disagree with Chief Superintendent John O'Brien, whose experience was that they jumped up and down when they received the letter from him. Maybe he had a sense of importance
Or a position of importance.
Pardon?
A position of great importance.
Well, he had a position of importance, and his vocabulary indicates that he had that position. But in my experience, Joe, and we had first-hand dealings with the Department of Justice, the last people that you would expect to contact you about anything would be officials in the Department of Justice.
And can you imagine the Secretary-General landing at your hall door watching while you're watching Fair City on a Monday night?
Well, Joe, didn't it indicate the scale of the crisis that they were facing? Didn't reality dawn at some stage?
But was this not all pointed out to the Attorney-General 5 months ago?
But, Joe, there's a system of government.
James, I want to bring more people in. No, you will stay with us. 51551. Eddie McBride, retired from the Gardaí 2 years ago. Eddie, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Joe.
You say you're glad to see the back of Martin Callanan.
Absolutely, and I think our all working guards out there on the street who are doing an excellent job. I think since the former Commissioner Martin Callanan's appearance before the PAC, mm-hmm. I think all those members are highly embarrassed by what has taken place to date. And I think it's great for the force now. This is a new beginning. It's a new dawn, and hopefully we'll have a proper structure in place in the Phoenix Park.
And why you still haven't explained? Well, you haven't had time. Why was he right to resign, to retire?
Well, I think he had very little choice after his performance with the PAC. I mean,
but he said, according to Paul Reynolds, 30 minutes ago, in conversations he's had with people close to the former Garda Commissioner. The former Garda Commissioner was told by officials at the Department of Justice not to withdraw the word disgusting. The former Garda Commissioner Martin Callanan delayed withdrawing his use of the word disgusting to describe the behaviour of Garda whistleblowers following advice from Department of Justice officials, according to sources close to him. So he's been pulled twix and tween, hither and thither.
Yes. Yes, well, what I'd simply say about that is Martin Callanan appeared before the Public Accounts Committee to answer questions in relation to allegations of wrongdoing by the whistleblowers. And that was his function when he was there, just to answer those questions. But in the course of that, he took that opportunity to destroy the good name of the whistleblowers. And also, at the same time, it was a two-pronged attack. He was also warning others not to follow suit. And that's what took place there. And if you recall, Mary Lou MacDonald at the time pointed out to him that was a very strong thing to say, to use the term disgusting. And she's no shrinking violet in matters. And I mean, I think most people were taken aback by his use of the language on that day.
And was it you're saying he might have lost a head in using the language, but should he have lost his job because of it?
Well, I don't think he lost the head. I think it was completely calculated from top to toe. I mean, that was the plan set out there. When you go in to answer questions in relation to anything, no more than his experience in a witness box in most of the courts, in the Central Criminal Court, as he would have given evidence there many a time. You're professional policemen, we're professional investigators, and we deal with those sort of questions, difficult questions, all the time. And and giving an opinion is not needed or wanted at any stage in the court system, and it's just you're there to answer questions, and that's it.
Yeah, but in the court system, you're not being asked questions by 13 people opposite you of different political persuasions, of different levels of experience, of different backgrounds.
Indeed, that's correct. But you are
maybe with different agendas.
Yeah, different agendas, I'd say there's little doubt about that. But at the end of the day, I think they were all trying to get to the real issues. I mean, was there corruption, was there not? And
well, you were a guard up to 24 months ago. Is there corruption in the Gardaí?
Oh, I can't say whether there's corruption or not.
Well, did you ever come across anything untoward like that?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No.
And you were 30 years in the Guards.
I was 30 years
okay.
in the Guards.
So you can say, if you were a politician, you would say, and I know you're not, Eddie, you would say, in my experience, there is no corruption. Couldn't you say that?
Absolutely. And okay. That's all you can say. You can't say anything outside of your own experience. And I never came across corruption.
Did you ever come across, Eddie, taping in a Guards? Apart from the 999 cut, which people would expect to be taped, did
correct.
You ever come across anyone saying, can you give me the tape of that solicitor when at 4:30 yesterday afternoon, when that solicitor came in to see that Yumfla in room number 4, and then he rang, and we know he rang, the Yumfla rang him at 4:50 after he left. Can you give me the tape of that phone call? Did you ever come across anything like that?
Absolutely not. And in my time in as an investigator out there, I mean, at no stage did that ever take place, and nor were we ever aware that such a facility existed.
Okay.
to tape phone conversations.
If you were, for example, if you wanted to get the record or the recording of a 999 call for your investigation,
yes,
to get,
yes,
the exact wording or phrase that,
yes,
was used or located, how would you get that recording? How would you set about getting that recording?
That would normally, things like that, we would normally, from an investigation point of view, we would send a request up to the IT section or,
okay,
to the telecom, and they would forward the necessary information broken down into the tape or whatever, you know.
But you would have to go through a process. You couldn't walk.
Absolutely.
You couldn't walk into a room in a station and say to somebody, spool through whatever, wasn't tape in those days, and from 2008 definitely wasn't tape. Spool through the file there and show me what was that phone call at 4:40 yesterday afternoon. You couldn't do that.
Absolutely not. No. That never took place. You know, as far as to the best of my knowledge and the most of the people I worked with, we never were aware that sort of thing went on. And in fact, we'd be horrified to think that our conversations were being taped if that was the case.
Joe, can I ask a question?
JJ, yeah.
How much paper, it is a survey member, what level of paperwork would you have to complete to get at this information? Now, I spoke to a guard yesterday. He served here in Fermoy. I know the man well. I was out for a walk and met him by accident. And he explained to me how the telephone call came to light in Waterford.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing mysterious about it, and there's nothing sinister about the call in Waterford. The case that went to hearing, I'll explain it if you want.
Yeah, I do. The case was the man that was assaulted in the Garda station.
Yes.
And there was CCTV footage, and then the camera was pointing at where the incident was taking place.
And then a phone call.
The man on duty
in the station telephoned his colleagues, and he said, guys, you're on camera.
And there's a good recording of that phone call.
But that was... Joe, I have heard many things, and I had many close relationships. I was absolutely astounded to learn that call was recorded. Now, I know there's amazement that John Redmond of AGSI said that he didn't know it. He didn't know a call. And I would suspect that many people... Joe, a new superintendent came to Fermoy one time, and he was an unusual man, to say the least. But he had served in various detective divisions in Dublin Castle. And he told me that they were suddenly moved to Harcourt Square. And a big safe was found that couldn't be opened, and that they blew the safe open.
Mm-hmm.
And envelopes with wads of cash went in all directions because men had been promoted and moved on. Now, that was the level at which the Garda force operated. There was honesty and there was accountability, and you put the money into an envelope and you put your name on it and you put the court case. Then you were promoted, moved on, you forgot about the envelope. The Garda force, Joe, has been running your shoes. I have thought now seriously about what you said to me.
Okay. I was making the point about 2008 and the money that was given to this system. But you could also say to me, or I've said it before here, I still don't think you can. You still can't email a Garda station. Like, in terms of technology, they're not exactly groundbreakers, are they? They're not going to win any awards.
We were through it. I have personal experience. In 1998, the Department of Justice set out a tender to computerise the court system, and I was retired at the time, and I had an interest in technology, and we put together a consortium. We had a very high-powered team that included Unpost, and we attended a briefing in the Davenport Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I have with Trevor Smith with me. He was a government account manager with a BDM Largo team. And after 1 hour of the briefing at 11 a.m, he passed me a note. He said, "This is not for real." He said, "This is not for real." And when lunchtime came, he said, "Guys, we'll disband because this tender is going nowhere." You can't run a complicated organisation on a shoestring. It is no exaggeration to say that Garda cars are clapped out. And previous governments and previous ministers know this.
Okay. Let me bring Andrew Dillon in. 51551. Andrew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
A solicitor for over 40 years. You're listening to this whole discussion, especially the intensity of it in the last few days. How do you think Alan Shatter has fared, your legal colleague, so to speak?
Well, I have to say, at the beginning, I've never met the man in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I have, I confess, I have great respect for him as a minister. I think it's... I don't understand exactly what has happened in the most recent days in terms of who said what to whom and when it was said and so on. And that wasn't what I really wanted to get into. I think that there is a serious agenda here which worries me terribly. I'm out of it now, so it's of little concern to me. I'm largely retired.
Okay, what is the serious agenda?
The Alan Shatter has tried to bring in a very interesting legal services reform bill,
mm-hmm.
which has been going on now for upwards of 2 years. I think the bill is 2011. It's now 2014. It's now very much on the back burner. I was bewildered when the Labour Party... No, I'm only quoting what I've read in the paper.
Yeah, they opposed it, yes.
Objected to the element where you could have a sort of a multidisciplinary practice.
A one-stop shop, yeah.
A one-stop shop. Now,
Where is this feeding into what's happening in the last...
This is feeding into... Alan Shatter has not endeared himself to the judiciary. Clearly, if you reduce somebody's wages, they aren't going to light candles for you. Secondly, he hasn't... He's not liked by the Law Society because he wants to drag the profession kicking and screaming into the modern era. He's not liked by the Bar Council because he's trying to interfere with their lifestyle.
And their incomes.
And their incomes. And I'm very worried about that because I'm quite familiar with the workings of the...
Yeah, but my question again is, how does that feed in to your theory about what's happening in the last few days?
If Alan Shatter resigns as Minister for Justice...
Okay.
There will be, and sorry for avoiding, I wasn't avoiding the question.
I know.
Alan Shatter resigns as Minister for Justice, that bill will never see the light of day as an act. And there will be a lot of extremely happy professional lawyers all around the country who will be absolutely delighted. I also think that the civil service is not entirely blameless in this, in that if I'm a minister of whatever, and I'm trying to bring in this reform or that reform, which may in some way impact on my employees, as it were, in the government department, they're not exactly going to assist me in that. And I've had lots of friends and people, the same as yourself, who happen to have become a minister at some stage, and they have on occasion explained to me situations where they were thwarted at virtually every turn. Now, I have no idea what goes on in the Department of Justice. I wouldn't be surprised if elements within his own department ensured that correspondence or documents, which he should see immediately, if not sooner, were withheld to such and such a date. I'm reminded of a time long ago when Harry Whelehan was Attorney General, and I said this to your researcher. Harry Whelehan did not stuff the Brendan Smith file behind the radiator.
We know that, and don't say that. We know that.
Somebody did. I don't know who did.
Well,
he doesn't know who did.
It was put together.
I do believe I'm surprised that the press, of all people, who normally are denigrating lawyers to their heart's content, are so intent on shafting Minister Shatter. I think the press is being egged on by the legal profession generally and fed whatever dirt it can be fed in order to gut Shatter. Shatter suffers, if he suffers from anything, from a degree of self-confidence, which I respect. He's self-confident because he knows what he's talking about, and he knows what he's doing. He also knows what he's up against.
Okay.
He's holding firm.
Okay.
And self-confidence, I want to finish one last point, Joe.
Yeah.
Self-confidence is often interpreted as arrogance. But he's frequently called arrogant. I don't know the man at all, but I do know what self-confident people sound like from time to time, and it does sound remarkably like arrogance. I don't believe in his case he's necessarily arrogant. The fact that he may know more about something than you or I and say so doesn't mean he's arrogant. It means he's got confidence.
Stay with us. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Susan Gray is on the line. Susan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
JJ is still there, as is Andrew, and I'll bring in Des in a sec. Susan, on the penalty points issue, you say, as people were talking about yesterday, OK, there's one issue at political level about who knew what and discretion and non-discretion and allegations of corruption. But you're saying, as people were saying yesterday, in the courts, on the ground, so to speak, the implementation of the penalty points scenario is bordering on a sham.
Yes, without a doubt, Joan, it has to be highlighted now. Even though the squashing of the penalty points, that's gone now. You won't see Gardaí squashing penalty points. We'll see loads and loads of more people summoned to court on road traffic offences. Now, what we're seeing in the courts is, it's just so alarming. There's a Road Traffic Act 2010 that was passed 4 years ago with excellent laws to stop people going to court, number one, claiming that they didn't receive the notice and walking out without double points. Right? Now, that loophole was closed in the 2010 Act, but it still has not been enacted by Mr. Bradler. He tells us he's unable to enact it because the courts, the court service and the Gardaí have not got the IT system up to scratch yet. Now, this is 4 years after that law was passed. Now, today we received a letter from Minister Bradford.
Okay, in other words, the change you want is that people shouldn't have to wait to get that letter, and then they can go into court, which I'm sure happened. Some people didn't get the letter. You're saying that once you're stopped and there's a fixed charge penalty, you should be given a certain period to pay it, full stop.
Yeah, well, you're given up to 56 days to pay it. If you don't, then you're automatically summoned to court. But many people are claiming, some of them may be truthful, but it's alarming how many is doing it, claiming they did not receive the penalty point notice. Now, the third payment option, which is a law that was passed in 2010, would close that loophole. When the person would receive a summons to attend court, they would also receive a notice, a penalty, a fixed charge notice, giving them 7 days to pay that before they go to court. If they don't, then they don't have to attend court.
That is assuming you'll read the letter that you get. Most people, in my experience, never read the correspondence they got. They went to somebody else with it.
The summons would be delivered to you, so you could never go to court on the summons thinking that you didn't receive the notice.
There are many stages before the summons arrives.
Could the system be simplified, JJ?
Of course it could be simplified. So the involvement of Unpus, record the delivery, is the answer to the problem.
We said that yesterday. Why don't they do that?
Well, Joe, I mean, why aren't things done? The obvious is always the most difficult to see. Joe, we have the misconception, not wishing to take from the comments made. No, you have the public misconception, Joe, and public misconception is open to interpretation, that Minister Shatter receives, and every minister receives and opens every letter.
Yeah, I know. Well, people don't at that.
But they do, Joe. The current debate indicates. The current debate would lead. What would an ordinary person conclude? The current debate is that Minister Shatter received this. They sent it to the Department of Justice. And that letter had to be parsed and analysed and read and reread. And the scale of the import had to be calibrated.
Yeah, but you're missing the key opening line of the letter from the Garda Commissioner. First of all, it's from the Garda Commissioner and said, I wish this to be drawn to the attention of the Minister immediately.
But in due course. But immediately could be due course. The great phrase, Joe, in the Department of Justice is due course. You see, Joe...
Okay. No, Joe, this is like, yes, Minister.
Secretary and staff, and a former government secretary told me this. Secretary and staff see it as their responsibility to manage the day-to-day affairs of government departments. And they then distribute correspondence to who it is ultimately aimed at in due course. Now, Joe, it is bordering on unbelievable that a letter of this scale of importance...
Joe, can we go back to the courts? I'll go back in a sec,
because I need to clarify. JJ, what are you saying there? It's unbelievable
that a letter of this importance did the rounds before it reached No, I heard Rachel, the TD for Meath, say last night that Minister Shatta got it at 12:40 a.m. on the night of Monday night, Tuesday morning. That even having been told by the Taoiseach, the letter still wasn't produced until the early hours of the morning. Now, why that happened, I don't know. But, you see, Joe, if you're in a government department and you don't know that there's a recording system in a Garda station, or that it's widespread, or that it isn't widespread, or that it doesn't exist, how... I can see how that letter had to be part-analysed. Joe, go back to...
Yeah, but the same government department would have had to sign off on the budget for that system.
But
in 2008, which is a big budget.
I don't know how far back this goes now, but Michael McDougall, who would be lauded as a great Minister for Justice, he supervised this system. He oversaw it. Dermot Ahern oversaw it. Now, Joe, I would like to know how the perception has been formed, or the opinion has been formed, that Alan Shatter is responsible for the recording system in the Garda station.
Okay.
Alan Shatter came into government new, and quite clearly, not everything has been brought to his attention. Ministers are briefed on a need-to-know
basis. Okay, and it would be brought to your attention, for example, if a significant amount of money was needed to upgrade it, which happened in 2008. I take your point. Let me bring Des
money,
in.
Money determines and triggers everything.
Okay, Des, follow the money. Des, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Nice to talk to you.
Likewise. You were a guard as well, Des.
I was a long time ago,
and
yeah.
You say you remember Martin Callan as being a very articulate and cultured man.
I do.
He is the main... Now, I know the arguments about the whistleblowers, what they suffered, but in terms of the high-profile jobs, he is the one and only victim of all of this. What do you think of the fact that he resigned, or had to resign, or had to retire, or had to fall on a sword?
Well, it's sad. I mean, that'd be the first thought. Very sad and very wasteful. But then again, and it's, 30 years since I left the job. I left as a young man when I became ill and had to take retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But as I watched it and kept in touch with the lads, the waste, the awful, awful waste for such a small country. When we look at Brian O'Driscoll retiring and how are we going to replace him and the talent, and we do it. We've been doing it with the police for years. We've been using up young men, bright men, talented people, and then when it suits the situation, they retire. I read somewhere. I think of and the numbers. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think there've been 19 commissioners, and I think only 9 of them finished naturally. There's been a whole list of them that had to go. I think it's just wasteful at that level, at the depot, which is a separate police force, really, from the people you see on the street.
What, the depot, as in, is the administration?
Depot,
is the,
well, the depot is another police force. I mean, we always regarded it as another police force. I mean, they even wear a different uniform. It used to be a matter of contention that they wouldn't wear the cloth we wore, but it's politics. It's every officer after the rank of inspector is a political appointment. They depend on the favour of politicians or the next lot of politicians.
Well, they're not, in fairness, now every my understanding is every rank beyond inspector is not a political appointment. They don't just pick a name out of a hat.
No, they don't. But they're, what happens?
The names are forwarded to the minister.
They're forwarded to the department, and then they're discussed. I agree. I put that wrong.
But I take your point that when it comes to commissioner and assistant,
if you want to be a sergeant, you have to get your head into the code, and you have to get your head into studies. And if you want to be an inspector, the same. And after that, lately, a lot of the men have gone away and done degrees and educated themselves at their own expense. The perception was that was rarefied atmosphere. That was not so much to do with Mrs. Murphy and the young fella kicking the ball up against her wall. It was to do with politics and promotion. You were on the ladder, and latterly then they seemed to try and address that, and you had guys like Martin Callanan, who had massive investigation experience, not to exaggerate, but kept the country safe. through a rotten time when I joined the job, and really we were pulled in the 70s because they needed people quickly. We a lot of us only did half our training because they needed us out on the border or whatever, and it really paramilitarized, if that's the right word, a job that should have been you and chasing the young fellas away from Mrs. Murphy's wall. It was an old sergeant, not an old sergeant, but a sergeant, an elder sergeant. Well, to me, he was a father figure. And he used to say, remember, young fella, if the force doesn't work for Mrs. Murphy, it doesn't work. Always remember that. Don't get any more complicated.
Joe yesterday made the same point. He said to me, the Templemore is turning out an impersonal policeman.
Okay, I want to go back.
The culture of the Gardaí, as that man explained, is what I knew, and we all knew one another, and we stood by one another. But it's difficult today, Judge, in an impersonal force where people are expendable. Martin Cannon became expendable.
Yeah, but it's different. James, it's a different world as well.
Of course,
you know,
culturally, Joe, we've changed.
It's a different world, Joe, and I mean, the Templemore that I was in was like a military barracks. I mean, the history of it, which they don't go over, is that we just replaced the Royal Irish Constabulary. Reckoned at the time to be one of the best police forces in the world, and actually set up the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yeah, okay, but today,
Joe, reckoned to be the best in the world. When you hear day after day, the kicking, the verbal kicking of a force that held the country together from the very same politicians who were in there today. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that young fellas that I knew, mm-hmm. who lost their lives, held this together, stood up against people who, and it's very difficult to stomach sometimes. It stood up against people who today are in government
and looking for accountability.
Well,
it's Alice in Wonderland gone.
Okay.
And who's to suffer?
Roderick, stay there. 51551. Roderick Tyrrell. Roderick in Dublin 4. Roderick, good afternoon.
Yeah, yes, Joe. Roger Tyrrell here. Just to go back to that, if I heard correctly, that retired solicitor.
Andrew Dillon, yes.
If I heard correctly, the notion that he's putting across is that there's a conspiracy or a push.
He said there's a lot of people, including the legal profession, who have agendas against Alan Shatter.
Yeah. Yes, but removes into the realms of the gunman, the grassy knoll theory, you know, that somehow or other there are nebulous forces of solicitors there pushing forward the agenda that the minister should resign in order that the legal services bill be avoided. That's a huge step. It's about the same step as the third gunman and the grassy knoll. But having said all that, it's also actually wrong. In fact, the majority of solicitors, the battle over the legal services bill, well fought, well done. It's over. It's done. It's ready to be in. It's ready to be brought in, and most of the solicitors are just waiting for it to be brought in, including the Law Society.
So
it's over. That battle's over.
So they support the one-stop shop.
Well, the one-stop shop is only a part of the legal services bill. As it stands at the moment, there probably is in existence a one-stop shop. The one-stop shop is a no threat to your local high street solicitor. It is a big threat to the big practices. But the majority of solicitors are one- and two-man practices.
Okay. Des,
it's a non-event.
Des, JJ, Bunyan, Roger.
The main point, thanks for coming back to me, that I just reading up on my bit of history and I read that in 1968, which was about 4 or 5 years before I joined, Judge Conroy was asked to have a look at this police force and bring it into the 20th century.
The Conroy report, yeah.
And he handed the minister at the time, Micheál Amuraán, he handed him the report in 1970 and said, you need a police authority. You need a separation of the police from the politicians. And then the Morris Tribunal, which was a superb piece of work by Judge Morris.
Well, it accused the Garda authorities of having a misplaced loyalty.
A fabulous opportunity, because okay. he bored down through all the different levels, and he said, and he made the point that unless you tackle this with a police authority, you are wasting talent, young talent. The force the country cannot afford to waste this talent. A police authority is what needed. A separation from politics and the Department of Justice, because it will cut out any cronyism. It puts the people back with a police authority back to talk, which we were told in Templemore.
And accountability, that was the big thing
agency.
As well. Accountability.
You are not cops. You are facilitators. You're guardians of the peace. You go to a problem, and you assist the people in coming to some form of resolution. And we were told that over and over and over. You are not a law enforcement agency. Now, your points issue, and you're fine on the spot, and all the things that have been brought in afterwards. They are creating a law enforcement agency, and the force is unbalanced. I don't think it knows what it is or what's expected of it, and it badly, badly needs a root and branch and
focus. Okay.
A police authority that will take it away. Because look, it's I don't know how long governments last, how long this government might last.
To 2016, they're adamant. They're adamant.
You need long-term planning. To put something, and it's not. We don't invent the wheel. There's plenty of examples around the world. Okay. All they need to do is look.
Okay, Des, James Bunyan, Roderick Tyrrell, Susan Gray, 51551. Back with more after this.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Vincent is in Clondalkin in Dublin 22. Vincent, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe? How are you?
Good, thanks. And when I was referring earlier to that whole issue of it's a different world now to JJ. I was thinking about places like Clondalkin and that incident last night. I know it's nothing to do with what you phoned about, but like there's people being shot randomly. There's gangland shootings and killings is almost regarded as entertainment these days. But anyway, Vincent, you have your own story about what happened to you in terms of a driving offence. Compared to what I've been talking about, extraordinarily minor. What happened, Vincent?
But basically, Joe, last October I received a summons in the post, mm-hmm. and it was for a driving offence, a speeding offence. So I went into court, and I more or less got up on the stand and said to the judge that, you know, the first notification I had of this was the summons. I said, I never received a fine. And I said, and secondly, I said, the day that was in question, I said, I wasn't driving the car. I said, my wife was driving the car. Mm-hmm. So the judge, more or less, him and the guard spoke, and the guard kind of got up and asked me a couple of questions, and I kind of answered them. And then the outcome of it was then that the judge fined the owner of the car, which was me, mm-hmm. The fine, and or 200 euros, I think it was, and penalty points on my licence. So I was kind of going like, this is a bit like, you know, this can't be happening, you know. So I basically got some advice from a solicitor, and then I more or less ended up going to the appeal courts.
And the solicitor said to you, the legislation is that it's a driver of the car.
They were kind of saying that he shouldn't have really done what he done, you know, and, you know, he fined the owner of the car, but, like, I wasn't driving the car at the time. I said my wife was driving the car, but it was kind of like, you know, I was guilty regardless, you know. And I was kind of just going to play along with it and just say, look, you know, just pay the 200 fine and all. But then this list was kind of saying to me, it's not even the fact you to pay the fine. You need to go and get your name cleared. Yeah. Like, you're more or less being accused of something that you didn't do. And so that's kind of why I took it up and ended up in the appeal courts.
And how'd you get on?
Well, I had to obviously get a barrister. Yeah. I explained everything to him, and the solicitor actually got me to the barrister and went in, and I had to get up and say the same again, exactly what had happened. And the judge, the guard that was in question, obviously, you know, when you go back to court, to the appeal court, you take more or less the government or the guards back to court to fight your case. And the guard had more or less stood up in court and said that, oh, he never showed up on the, you know, on the original date for the summons. And the judge kind of said, well, he obviously did show up, because, you know, why would he be in the appeal courts now, guard? So, to be honest, it was kind of the first experience of kind of going through. But, like, you know, I missed days at work trying to get it sorted and running around. And at the end of it, like, it ended up costing me money. But it was more or less just to kind of get my name cleared. Like,
and was
that,
your name,
you know,
cleared?
Was, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the judge said, well, who got the points then?
No, nobody. Well, what happened was... The barrister kind of said to the judge, like, you know, he doesn't need, you know, he works kind of drives for a living, so he can't kind of have the point on his license. So, you know, I was kind of stricken from the.
Yeah,
the
but if you say it was your wife that was driving, did you bring your wife to the court? And
I did. I brought my wife to the court with me as well, and, you know, she wasn't called to the stand, and she wasn't, you know, so whatever kind of the barrister and the judge agreed, like, you know, no, the penalty points, none of us got them. So.
And then did you clarify this whole issue of why the judge gave it to the owner of the car? I know there's certain pieces of legislation where the owner of the car is regarded as being liable for, in terms of tax, insurance, all the carry on. But
yeah, but normally when you get the fine, as which has happened in the past, because what I was asked was, did you ever receive penalty points in the past? And I said, yes, I was driving my wife's car. And I said, when the fine came in, I filled out the details and put my license down and sent it off, and I got the penalty points for it. But I said, look, I just, in this circumstance, like, how can, you know, if we didn't get the fine, how can we kind of put down who was driving in the car? So that was the whole point. We kind of never got the fine. We only got the summons, and because we kind of got the summons, we were kind of guilty, you know.
Well, when you said, because, you know, there's a infamous case in the UK, Chris Hughan and his wife Vicky, and they broke up, and she then revealed that she had taken penalty points for him. And then both of them were done for perjury. Both of them ended up in prison. Were you ever advised when you said, Your Honour, or Justice, it wasn't me who was driving? Were you advised by the court now, if you perjure yourself, you're into a much more difficult legal terrain?
Nothing like that. No, I just, my case was just that the first notification was the summons. There was no fine. I was just the summons. And the second thing was I wasn't driving the car at the time. I said my wife was driving the car. And then the guard kind of asked me where you live and do you have any, you know, problems with your post or this, and I kind of went, no, you know, as far as I know, no.
Hmm.
And they kind of talked between themselves, and then, you know, I still kind of got, you know, more or less, you know, fined €200 and penalty points on my license. So I was kind of calm, like, this is a bit, you know. When I looked into sort of the legal advice with the solicitor, I was kind of more or less, you know, it's not the fact I was going to just say, look, I'll just pay the 200 and forget about it. But it wasn't that job. It was, to get my name cleared. Because, you know, after all, I wasn't driving
the car.
And you've done that.
Okay, Vincent, you live, and I know Clondalkin's a big area and spreads across. But, I mean, all this, now I know, but another shooting last night up there, the whole John Gilligan episode, the episode in Lucan. Is that noticeable to people living in Clondalkin on a day-to-day basis? Is there a noticeable guard or presence?
Seems to be getting worse as the weeks are going on. It doesn't seem to be getting any better, put it that way.
Yeah, but people don't notice increased guard or presence or.
Not really. As I said, you have to go into the local police there, and they do the best they can there, but I just, my situation with that, I just kind of thought the whole thing was, like, I'd never kind of been down that road before, and I just thought it was a bit of a farce, Joe, and it was kind of just, you know, everything was just, in the end, I was out of pocket regardless of what.
Because you had to hire
the
solicitor and the barrister, otherwise, I take the point. Thanks indeed, Vincent. 51551.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Brian Connolly is in Meath. Brian, good afternoon. You were what?
Hello,
Andy,
Joe.
Well, you're, again, penalty points.
I had a very weird one, Joe, about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a notice out for two summonses, and which was four penalty points. And when I studied the whole thing, it came out that I was supposed to be in a part of Swords, two different parts of Swords, at the same time, being, on camera.
Mm-hmm.
So when I queried this, I got on and I said to the girl, do you know that the address that you have me down for, it should be the M1, not Listen Hall Swords, which is on the north side of Swords. And she said, oh, right, yeah. And I said, and do you know that the other part, which is at the far end of Swords, which would be the airport side of sorts. I said, as a housing estate. I said, I didn't know you had any speed traps in housing estates. Hmm. So she went, oh, and went off, came back, and she said, oh, the good news is, she said, we're dismissing the one on the south side as a technical problem. Now, what brought me to ring you, Joe, was okay. exactly that guy that was on to you there a few minutes ago about his wife driving the car and he was getting the fine. There's something radically wrong, Joe, when you get a notice and all you can see is your registration number and halfway up the car. Who's to say that that's your car? Why not show the whole thing with the person that's driving the car? Because if that was the case, they wouldn't have sent that out to him.
Well, yeah, but you...
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but like, you need... Like, you could be talking about data protection, identifying people in the car. Well, you wouldn't be just doing the driver, I presume.
Well, I believe, Joe, you can get this, but it costs you money to get it. There's a fine, there's a charge.
Oh, you can ask for another photograph.
Yes, you can ask for the full showing of the car, the front of the car, which shows the person driving.
Okay, but you were told it was simply a technical error, that you got two summons as a possibility, four
yeah.
penalty points
yeah.
for the same time but at two different locations, and
exactly.
you managed to get it down to two. Let me bring Padraig Duggan in
yeah.
and listen to his idea of what's
okay.
happening in the States. Padraig, good afternoon. Thanks, Brian. Padraig, you say there's a unique system in the States, which on first reading of your call here sounds fascinating. When you get your first driving license, you get your first car, you get a reg number, which you bring with you through every car, basically.
Absolutely. You can buy a new, well, say if you're living for a while, you have an old car,
mm-hmm.
and you buy a new car, you keep your old plate.
So the plate comes with you onto the new car?
Well, if you buy a new car, first of all,
yeah.
say if you're a 20-year-old, it happens to be a new car, any car, you get a temporary sticker until you get your license plate. And once you get that license plate, you keep it for life. If you sell on your car, trade it in, you keep the old plate, and probably after 10 years, might be a bit battered or worn, you get a new plate, but it's the very same number.
It's like your PRSI number. Your
Your
PPS numbers is now called.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's nothing about vanity over there. It's a bunch of numbers and words.
And what do you mean there's nothing about vanity? People don't bother if others don't realise they're in a brand new car.
Exactly. I heard Conor Faulkner this morning about people waiting for 3 or 4 months now for an NCT test. The reason is because if you buy a new car in January, there's a whole bunch of cars due for NCT in January of 2018. But in America, people don't buy their cars in January because of the new car you could buy in April, July or August because nobody will know what year it is.
And when when you move through states or, you know, change address in different states, you have to change your... No, you don't. You just...
No, well, see, there's a law in different states, but you're allowed at least 6 months. If I move to California from Chicago, keep my place for 6 months, now I could be there for years. If you weren't caught for a moving violation, nobody will know how long you're in the state. But also, there's a very important security factor because people here pull over for whatever violation,
mm-hmm.
and the policeman should know immediately who owns that car. And by here, you sell your car, and the place stays on. And so, if a guy said, well, I didn't own that car in February, I sold it in January. But the policeman knows straight away who you are, and if you steal the license plate, and you put a Ford license plate on a Chrysler car, he will know that there's something wrong here. So it's very simple and very straightforward. And if you're pulled over for a driving ticket for speeding, mm-hmm. your ticket, that is your court date. They say if you're pulled over, say, in Galway, there might be 4 hours set aside every first Monday of the month for speeding tickets. So you'll know on the spot once the policeman gives you your ticket, there's no more notification. The address of the courthouse is on there.
Mm-hmm.
Show up at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and you might get 50 or 60 people together there in front of the judge. You call a 50 or 60 name and say that you're all doing 10 or 20 miles an hour over the limit. Do you accept an $80 fine, pay your fine, no penalty points, and just pay the clerk of the court, move on, job done. Very simple.
Can you pay without going to court, as you can?
Oh,
here?
You can if you want to.
Okay.
Yeah, but like I said, but you're saying
you're told, if you're pulled up in a particular area, you're told if you want to challenge the speeding ticket or whatever, if you don't want to pay it in the meantime, the first Monday or the first Tuesday or the second Wednesday afternoon of every month deals with speeding cases. So the next second Wednesday afternoon following this event, you can turn up and challenge.
Exactly.
Okay. And exactly. Parik, I know you're. Are you in the States at the minute? No, you're here. You're here. But you're,
no, I'm here at the moment. Okay. And also, all the license plates that go on every car in the state of Illinois, I know that for sure, maybe other states, but they're made by prisoners in the jail.
Okay.
And also, for road taxes right over there, all you do, you get a little sticker on the back of your number plate. It's very luminous. Cannot take it off. And the policeman doesn't have to pull you over to see if your tax is paid up to date. He knows by the month of on the sticker of the car, so he needn't bother pull you over and causing traffic jams to see if your tax is paid or
That's
not.
That's a good point. So this luminous sticker is placed where?
It's about an inch square. It's on the lower left-hand corner of your rear number plate. So if the squad car is driving
But hang on, sure, if that was, you know, the argument you get here, Parik, if you start doing that on Reg Place, fellas will be on their hands and knees late at night in every car park robbing the stickers.
Well, you know, they're so good, you cannot take them off. It's just impossible.
Okay.
They're well done, and there's so many things in this country that's so complicated. I think it's just jobs for the boys. There's nothing simple, nothing streamlined, and nothing ever changes.
And Parik, what do you think of the shenanigans of recent days?
Well,
you're thinking of going back to the States?
I was listening to Gail Byrne last Sunday, and he's involved, of course, for all the right reasons with the Road Safety Authority. But he even said, when you're on the inside, there's a kind of culture of secrecy in the Garda. And he said it's almost uneasy, the culture of secrecy that's in there.
Okay, yes?
Okay,
thank you, Parik. Parik Duggan, and let me go to Hugh in Cork. Your father is telling you about what they did in the guard at the need in the Gardaí to keep records.
Yeah, Joe, my father's retired for over 20 years, but he said going back 30, 40 years ago, wherever he was stationed, they would log every call that came in a logbook. They would record the context of the conversation and what it was about, and then that would be reviewed by the sergeant and the superintendent. Basically every day, you know. So he called it recording, you know, it was still recording even though they didn't have tapes or the digital now, but it was still recording by any other means. And it was really to protect the guard as well and also to protect the person who rang in, you know.
Yeah. But I think, and again I come back to what Des and Eddie said earlier, and indeed Walter Kilcullen said at 20-3 on Tuesday when the statement came out from the government about this recording in Garda stations and the implications. Walter and every guard we've had on since said they were unaware of this. And then when we interrogated it, they said even if they were aware of it and there were tapes, for example, on 999 calls, if you wanted to retreat them for an investigation, there was a whole series of hurdles you had to get over. But now we have it's a very unusual crisis at the minute because when things like this emerge, the government normally try and calm people and say, listen, this is not as serious as it looks, or let's see how it unfolds. But like almost by the hour, government ministers and the Taoiseach today said, this is even more serious than we thought it was 2 days ago. It's now tribunals are going to be implicated. So it's a very unusual crisis, or very unusual drama that the government are saying this is... Instead of calming people down, they're saying this is much worse. But every guard that we've spoken to said we're never even aware of it. So how could it be used to say that cases have been contaminated?
Well, you see, as I said, no, the point you're talking to the dad, right, in that it was standard practice to write everything down, to which he said is recording anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, obviously, if someone is recording a conversation between a solicitor and a client or... that would be a separate issue again, you know, but I presume that the likes of those would be...
And did he have discretion,
very
Hugh?
Small.
Yeah.
And, well, discretion then, I mean,
You see, the problem, you said, the way the force is going, right, that girls have always had discretion, right? And he said, you know, if you arrested someone for some minor offence, right, it could be, you know, drunken disorderly, it could be vagrancy, it could be, you know, petty theft, regardless, right? And I mean, you see it on every cop show on the telly, right? You know, if it's a petty crime, if it's someone you know their character, if it's also somebody can say barter system where they can kind of say, look, I can give you someone who robs such and such a factory, or I can give you someone selling counterfeit goods or drugs or whatever, you know. If it led to something bigger, right, then you always had discretion, right, for obvious reasons, to make the bigger case or solve a bigger crime, you know.
Okay.
And no, he's talking about petty stuff, obviously, but the problem, really, he said, no, is that if everything is going to be so streamlined and you take the discretion away from the girls, right, then, yeah, you end up catching the small fella and you never catch the big fella, you know.
Okay, say that Carol is in Meath. Carol, what happened?
Hiya, Joe. Look, it's just more or less a query. Myself and my daughter's on my insurance, mm-hmm. and on this particular day, there was a lot of comings and goings regarding my car. You know, she came back, I went off, I came back, she went off. And we got 2 penalty points, but it was because I'm the owner of the car, it was actually addressed to me. But we genuinely didn't know who had gotten the points. So when I rang up to ask, how could I verify this? Could we have a photograph?
Okay, in other words, there was a time and a place given, and
yes,
the few of you that drive the car said, who was there? And you said, I can't remember. And
yes, exactly.
Okay,
but the two of us genuinely travelled this road 2 or 3 times.
On a regular basis. Okay.
Yes. So when I rang up to ask, could we have a photograph as to verify who should actually claim these points, I was actually told I couldn't have one because the photograph of the car was taken from the rear of the car. So I just said, well, who's going to take these points? And it was actually the advice I was given was, well, you could take your daughter to court. And I thought, what? Why would I want to do that? So between us, we kind of more or less flicked a coin, and my daughter took the penalty points.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, was that right or was it wrong? Or what should we have done at the time? And there was a lot kind of going on family-wise, and we just let it go. She took the points, but was that good advice? Was it wrong advice? I don't know.
And there's no way you could have sat down and worked out who was where, when?
We genuinely tried on the day. But when I say she was travelling back the road and I knew she'd be back a certain time, well, not a certain time, but within a time frame, and then I was going off, I did a quick little message, came back again, she then took the car. So we were kind of, really and truly, we were caught, but there was nobody out there to help us. And I just felt the only advice I was given was, take her to court. But, I mean, should they not have been able to provide a photograph as to show us who was driving this car? And can they, is it right or wrong to take it from the back of the car?
Well, we know they do take it from the back of the car. We know we know there's 2 cameras in the Gatsa, one at the front, one at the back.
Right.
Okay.
Caller where he just said that, you know, they didn't get one at all, but it was actually his wife.
Yeah, it was driving.
You know,
okay, so the coin was tossed and your daughter lost, so to speak.
Yes, she did.
Okay,
unfortunately.
And it's a serious addition.
But I just kind of felt it was a very strong thing to be told, look, in order to sort it out, take your daughter to court.
And what did it mean, take your daughter to court?
I just said to him, what do you mean? He says, well, if you take it in front of a judge and let a judge make a decision.
Yeah.
So I came away thinking, God, I can't do that to her.
Okay. Thanks, Carol. Let me bring. Okay. We might get an answer. Dermot Tracy's in Ballantyre. Dermot, you're on again about this guarded tapes. The Taoiseach is saying this morning in League Slip that this is much more serious than we even said. We said it was DEFCON 3 at 2:40 on Tuesday, that these tapes could have enormous implications for an enormous number of cases. And he said today now they can have enormous implications for numbers of tribunals. But you're saying that they're. Which I would have thought someone in government would say, hang on a minute, go ahead, Dermot. You say there should be a whole system if they were being used. Go ahead.
We make an assumption. We can probably assume that they weren't recorded in the Garda stations themselves. Okay. That was central in maybe Garda headquarters or somewhere. But somebody had to maintain the machines,
mm-hmm.
load the tapes, unload mm-hmm. the tapes, catalogue them. It was either a Garda or somebody working within the actual system. And that should not be that. I mean, there's writing on the tapes, I imagine, even as well. And that would be silly, but they might have even
Then why... These are surely basic questions, Dermot. Why, when this was brought up, and as J.J. Bunyan pointed out this was brought up quite a long time ago, well, in, within the last 2 years, in this infamous Waterford case. But yeah. Why didn't somebody ask the Garda commissioner, and he said he brought it up 4 months ago, before they called out to his house on Monday evening, why didn't someone ask the Garda commissioner, by the way, what happened to those tapes? Are they? Is there a whole department or a section within the Phoenix Park that catalogues, that archives, exactly. that numbers, yeah. or are they simply well, left in under the desk?
Otherwise, they'd never be able to trace them back to where they came from. And another
but
point...
Surely the, but my point is, surely the and the Kenny or whatever, the government, the Taoiseach, should find out before they say to Martin Callanan, there's going to be great disquiet about these tapes, should find out, it's a very simple question, as you say, the reader is a section archiving, cataloguing, maybe even listening to these tapes, or there isn't. What happened to them?
And I mean, the tapes don't have one conversation per tape. There should be multiple conversations, because they couldn't have been that discriminating to decide which call to record and which not to record. I said it must have recorded everything. So that means there are hundreds of thousands of these calls being recorded. I dread to think how many cases they are going to actually have.
And what was the system?
And how long it's going to take to sort it all out.
And what was, if these tapes were being used in this way, what was the system for retrieval? And if all the answers were, you know, this was a pro form, this was a system that was put in the 70s, it was updated as part of a telephone system, that end of it in terms of recording was used for 999, it's never been used for anything else, we can prove it was never used for anything else. Well, then that's the end of all this alleged contamination of previous cases and this stuff in the papers this morning about rapists and murderers possibly walking out the gates of Mountjoy, Weefield and Portlaoise and Cork and Limerick.
But at some stage, somebody like the Waterford case or the Truscan de Plantier case, a tape is going to emerge with this information on it, and that should tell an awful lot about the system.
Surely the case is that the question is, were these tapes ever used in cases?
Difficult to know, isn't it?
Okay, I take your point. Yeah,
it depends on what has been said.
Okay.
And then you'd have to go back to the court to see what was said there, not said even. If it was something that was important to the defence and it wasn't passed to the defence, it's endless, the complications
I take that point. A tape kind of warms in that sense because you simply have to allege that a Garda used information ascertained through a private conversation, and then you're into a whole quagmire. Okay, thanks indeed, Dermot.
You're welcome.
Thank you indeed. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Anne, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Good. You say you're fed up, and God, I wouldn't blame you. All the bad publicity about Clondalkin.
Yes, absolutely, Joe. It's just horrific.
Well, is it horrific, the publicity, or horrific what's been happening?
Well, what's happening is only a very small fraction of Clondalkin.
Obviously,
Most people are really nice. I love where I live. I love all my friends, all my neighbours. It's just horrific hearing all this bad publicity. If it's good news, it's Lucan. If it's bad news, it's Clondalkin. I mean, the borders are going from the village right out to Liffey Valley.
And what should be said then when...
Well, now, when something happens in Fairhouse, it doesn't say Talla. Like, there's so many different townlands. If it were just in the townlands...
And if you come across anything, Anne, yourself... Never. Okay.
No. I walk down the village at 10:30 at night and nothing ever happens.
Okay.
But
you see the papers and you watch TV and you know it's...
I know it does. I know. But, I mean, if you take all the hundreds of thousands of people that live here, you know, why not say a townsland and then it wouldn't be all clumped in together?
Okay. And how long have you lived in Clondalkin, Anne?
About 30 years.
Okay. And you remember when it was just a small village with the round tower and the monastery and the
absolutely.
Right. Okay.
But I mean, they're just the people in Clondalkin are really lovely and really friendly.
Okay. I know you that. Know. All my family live up there, of course I know it. Anne, thanks indeed. That's Anne in beautiful Clondalkin, as you say. But let me go to Willie Cullen, Anne in Waterford. Willie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What happened?
Coming home one night, driving along at normal 100 plus or 100-ish kilometres, I came across some cars on a good stretch of road, overtook the three vehicles as it was on the day, and I got caught speeding, overtaken.
Yeah.
So I pulled in from, I was followed and pulled in down the road, and I was informed I was going to be summoned. I said, fine. I said, it's a bit harsh. I said, I was overtaken. He said, you were actually speeding, and he said, you're off limit. I said, fine. So he said, since that, I never got a summons. I never paid a fine. But I got notice slightly over 3 years further that my penalty times had been reduced.
Even though you never, you never thought you got any penalty points.
Precisely. Yeah. So I never got a fine. I never got a summons. I never got a fine or paid a fine. But I got penalty points.
And did you ever? I know you said you said to the guard, "Oh, that's a bit harsh because I was overtaken." If you had got the notification, did you intend fighting the case?
Not really, because the cost of actually fighting it, and by the time I go to court and lose in court, I get 4 penalty points. So what's the sense?
And isn't that that is the incentive for people, just to, even if they feel they're being harshly treated or there was a mistake, that is the incentive for people to say yes and take the points, isn't it? That if you go to court and you lose, it's doubled.
Of course. So you're better off just to take your pints and take your medicine and be done with it.
Okay. Safe travelling. But whether you were wrong, even the argument about overtaking doesn't hold. Sure it doesn't.
Well, how do you overtake without...
Willie, you don't. If you have to break the speed limit overtaking, you don't. It's not the area, not the line.
Well, it's not really. If you're behind somebody and they were doing 10 miles an hour or whatever, below the speed limit, surely you wouldn't overtake them at a 10 mile an hour speed, because that wouldn't make sense.
Well, then you
overtake quickly and decisively.
But you hold your breath, bite your lip, turn on the radio and just cruise along at 10 miles under the speed limit. The speed limit isn't a target. Do you follow me?
Technically, you are correct.
Maybe I should have been a guard, Willie. Okay. Listen, safe travelling. Do you hear me? Mind yourself, Willie. Willie Cullinan in Waterford. Derek Mooney is next. 51551 continues, as does Joe at RT.ie. And Siobhan Hawk was today's producer. Good afternoon.
1850-715-815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.